This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcaster are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it was a few events happened this week. Did you realize it was the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web?
Yes,
Tim Berners-Lee is sort of, you know, commiserating what's happened, sort of talking about what's going to happen in the future. And, of course, this was the week that that the U.S. government announced that they were going to free up the Internet from their control and sort of give up the Department of Commerce, controls over it. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting development as far as the Internet goes.
Mm-hmm.
And Time Magazine released the 100 most selfiest cities. The cities with
selfiest.
The most. The cities that had the most selfies per 100,000.
That's pretty funny.
So this
somebody actually bothered to calculate this.
Yeah, they calculated it. So I actually had to do it because I was wondering whether Washington D.C. would be on the list. It was actually number 25
You're
on the
kidding.
List. Which was, which was really quite surprising.
It is, because people here are so busy, I wouldn't imagine they had all that time to post all those selfies.
That's right. We're going to talk about the man who invented the progress bar.
Okay.
You know, the progress bar was actually invented, you know, that little thermometer
yeah.
thing that's laid on its side when you're downloading something. And did you realize that the buttonless Apple mouse was kind of invented by mistake?
No.
So we'll talk about that story. Oh, cool. And then yesterday was a very momentous day for me.
Pi Day?
Pi Day.
Yeah.
Pi Day.
You know, Pi Day next year is going to be even bigger.
It's going to be the Pi Day of a lifetime.
3.14.15.
Yeah, it's going to be the Pi Day of a lifetime, especially if you are at like 9:29. At 9:29.
Oh, that's right.
See,
yeah.
See, at 9:29 of next year, then you'll have that. Now, the man we're going to feature in Profiles NIT is the guy behind Flappy Birds. You've heard this Flappy Bird. The guy's made all this money, and it's just an interest. He's from Vietnam, actually. He was living with it in his parents' house in just outside of Hanoi when he wrote Flappy Birds. So it's a very interesting story. And of course, it was a huge mailbag.
Massive.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Wow.
Ooh, giant.
Do you need to take a break? Because you look out of breath.
You know, I'm going to have to start working out more, you know, because I've been having Drone do all my heavy lifting for me.
Lifting the mailbag once a week is not considered cardio.
Yeah, and see, at home I used to get more exercise, but now I have my drone do all the heavy lifting, so I've got to start working out. I've got to start pumping more iron. We got an email from Alice. Dear Tech Talk, I've had several people tell me that I got too much stuff on my desktop. This would be her computer desktop
right. She's
talking about.
Not her actual
yeah,
desktop.
Yeah, not her actual. That's probably a mess, too, because there's probably a correlation between computer desktop and physical desktop.
Yeah.
And they've been saying that that's why my computer's so slow. But I think my computer's slow just because it's old. It's 6 years old. What should I tell them? Thanks, Alice. Well, Alice, the good news is clutter on your desk does not affect the speed of your computer at all. It's just there. There's a bunch of icons on the desk waiting to be activated, and they don't use any processing power at all unless you click one. However, a cluttered desktop does indicate something.
Yeah.
It indicates kind of a lack of organization or efficiency. And like, you know, for instance, I have only a few icons on my desktop. I'm very proud of my desktop, you know. I try
Show
to keep
off.
All the clutter off. And so if I get a bunch of, if I'm doing a big project and I end up just for convenience saving a file on the desktop. After I finish with my project, I'll sweep them all up and I'll put them into a subdirectory in my documents bin. Before
well, aren't
you it's sort of like sweeping up the room after you've done a do-it-yourself project, you
Mr.
know?
Organization.
You know, so it's kind of what that means. Now, it is possible too that every time that you install a new program on your machine, it likes to just load all these icons on the desktop. It likes extra icons on the desktop because it wants to be the number one program on your computer. So it could be an indication that you've just installed a bunch of software programs. So all these free things, you download them and you just let them do whatever they want. You don't pay attention to the installation until finally your whole desktop is cluttered. So if that is the cause of a cluttered desktop, and if you've got a bunch of these programs that are activated during boot up so that they're on, that could slow down your machine.
Sure.
So I don't really know the source of your clutter, whether it's just sloppy installation or just sloppy document management. But I suggest that you just clean it up. But the good news is chances are it won't have much effect on your speed.
I take issue with you casting aspersions on those of us who have cluttered desktops.
Okay.
It just means that we're busy, Doc.
I know.
Sometimes I need something really fast. I drag it to the desktop and then move on to the next thing.
I know, but I got people at work that go into their office. Their whole desk is just filled with papers. They can't find anything.
There's a desk around the corner in this building. Have you seen it?
No. Oh, I'll have to check.
We'll have to show that to you later on.
And they can't find anything, and so it sort of indicates a lack of organization. On the other hand, some people I will admit are able to function very well in a cluttered environment.
So maybe
for them, it's not clutter. It's just a different organizational structure.
Here's the way I looked at it when I manage people. Okay. I don't care what system you have, mm-hmm. as long as you have a system.
So you're saying that clutter is in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly.
That's
what
you're saying.
I used to leave things out of my desk that I needed frequently so that I didn't
So you think I'm being far more too judgmental about this than I should be.
I think you are jumping to conclusions here.
Okay.
All right.
But it is true if it was caused by installing a bunch of software that would stay online.
Couldn't agree with you more. Could be a problem.
All right.
Okay.
We got an email from John in Alexandria. Dear Tech Talk, I'm worried about my accounts being hacked. How long should it be in order to be safe? Thanks, John in Alexandria. Well, for years, John, the standard practice was to say that 8 characters would be enough, as long as they were random and they just weren't like password or they weren't January or something like that.
1234.
Or 1234, yeah. But now, large-scale attacks have made this obsolete so that, in fact, size does matter.
Are we going there already?
If I could use a well-honed phrase.
Yeah, well...
Now, passwords today should have a minimum of 12 characters if you really want to be safe, and ideally it could be 16 characters. Now, let me explain why this is true. It's not somebody like going in and bringing up, say, your Gmail account and trying to hack into it because they couldn't do enough iterations to hack into your Gmail account through the user interface. What actually happens is that when websites are hacked, and hackers download files of passwords and usernames, this is when you got a problem. So now the hacker now has an entire file of usernames and passwords. Now, most websites now use the best practice that if they have passwords, they encrypt them. It's called hashing. And so the passwords are hashed and they're encrypted. And many of them use what they call salted encryption, which means they actually offset the number slightly. That's the salting, and the amount of offset varies. So that even makes it more difficult to reverse engineer the hashed numbers. Now, in the old days, when processing power was expensive, if they would try to break a hashed password of, say, 8 digits, that would be that would take them so long to do it that it wasn't worth it. But now with computers running at such high speeds and with parallel processing so available and processing so cheap, it's now possible for them to actually reverse engineer the hashtags of 8 bits quite easily. And so It turns out if they do, and they do a hash of an 8-character password, which would be totally random, it turns out there are 221 trillion combinations.
Wow.
But with brute force and with parallel processing, you could actually go through all those combinations in just a few hours. So actually, they could crack an 8-digit hashed password relatively easily. On the other hand, if you have 12 characters in your password, and they have to then, you know, brute force a hashed 12-digit or 12-character password, that would take them centuries. So then it's not worth it, because at the current processing time. And if you got 16, it would take them even longer. So the number of digits in your that you want to have in your password sort of depend on the state of processing speed. So maybe in 10 years, even 12 wouldn't be enough, and you'd have to go to the 16.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing. I mean, it's hard to remember. So let's get practical.
Sure is.
It's hard to remember some 16-digit password, but because we're more attuned to remembering phrases. So you remember a passphrase. Like, I could have a passphrase, the yellow brick road led to the Wizard of Oz. Okay? Now, that if I would take the spaces out of that, that turns out to be 36 characters in that password. And it's easy for me to remember.
Easy
but
it for
would
you, because you're a genius.
But it would be hard for somebody to get that out of a hashtag.
Mm-hmm.
And So the key is to use passphrases. Now, one of the problems with passphrases is that many services don't allow spaces. So you have to type your passphrase probably without spaces. And many don't allow such a lengthy one. But
that's right, yes.
But so I would recommend, especially for your bank account, I mean, if there are accounts that you really think that you just want to protect, I mean, and I'd go for 12 characters, and I'd use a passphrase, because I think I would have trouble remembering 12 characters.
Random
characters. But that's why 6 was so popular, because people can easily remember 6, and now maybe they can remember 8, but 12 gets more problematic.
But as you explained, the way that these things are hacked into now, because it's a computer that's searching, it doesn't matter whether it's still a phrase to you is still random. Letters to a computer,
it's
right?
It's still random letters, and if it's 40 digits, we're talking about thousands of centuries to do it. And so that's really very, very, you know, that's just not hackable. Now, what they do when they do these hacks, first of all, because they're people that just have stupid passwords, and so they, and so like,
like
one, two, one through nine, or it could be stupid, or it could be password written backwards. I mean, they've got all kinds of things. And so they have a list of all the stupid passwords. And unfortunately, when they do an attack on a hashed account, probably 20% of them are stupid passwords, so they just get them right away.
Yeah. Wow.
And so all the people that put in stupid passwords get their accounts hacked first. They get the honor.
The stupid people.
They get the honor. I didn't say they're stupid people. I just said they're stupid passwords.
Oh, stupid passwords.
See, I'm not.
I'm trying
to be sensitive, Jim. I don't want to reflect on the person.
I'm
you
sorry.
Know?
I don't want to be accused of bullying or anything like that over here.
So you add these symbols in it, it still doesn't increase the number of options that much. So maybe by just putting symbols in an 8-character password, it's equivalent to 9 characters
mm-hmm.
of just letters. So it's not that much of a shift. And so, but going to 16, I mean, when it comes to password, length matters. I'm just telling you, Jim, the longer the better.
Can you just go to the next letter, please?
Okay. We got an email from Don in Reston. Dear Tech Talk, I want to connect HDMI to my new flat panel TV that's mounted on the wall.
Show off.
Yeah. And I don't want to run ugly cables from my Xbox to my TV. And in parentheses, he's saying, actually, my wife doesn't want to see the cables.
Right.
Okay, this is always the problem. Cables don't seem to bother men, but you know why? You know the wives don't like black cables
so,
hanging around.
I guess the question is there a dongle for that?
What are my options? Yeah, there could be a dongle. Yeah, thanks. Dawn in Reston. Well, you need a wireless HDMI connection.
There you
go.
Or it'd
be wireless HDTV. Wireless HDTV. Now, in order to ensure, now wireless is going to operate in what they call the unlicensed band. So there's one unlicensed band at 2.4 gigahertz, and there's another one at 5.8 gigahertz, and that's used for most of your home stuff. Most people have their Wi-Fi network in the 2.4 gigahertz band. Bluetooth is in 2.4 gigahertz. So a lot of the stuff in your house is 2.4 gigahertz. So you don't want to interfere with that. So you want to pick a wireless device that's operating the 5.8 gigahertz band. That's first and foremost. And then you won't have interference. Now, there are a few options. Now, I went to Wirecutter. This is a website where... You know, these guys just take great delight in replacing wire with wireless. And according to Wirecutter, the best HDTV transmitter is $200, and most of them were around $200 frame. You can get some for $300, but most were... There wasn't much for much under $200 that had any kind of good review. They recommended IO Gear Wireless HD Digital Kit. Now, it transmits 1080p video, which is the current HD standard. That's 1080p, 1080, that means it's 1,080 horizontal lines sent progressively from top to bottom as opposed to being interlaced. That's what that progressive means. Interlaced means they would send every other line and then do the next every other line and then alternate. So you'd take two frames to transmit a full image. That was the old style interlaced. So they, with the new processing speed, they could get rid of interlaced, so they just do progressive. So 1080p is a standard video. And so it's a small receiver attached to your TV, and they claim they can transmit up to 100 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing is the IO gear has two HDMI inputs. So you could plug, for instance, your cable box in one input, and you could plug in your Blu-ray tuner, Blu-ray DVD player in the other one, and the Blu-ray DVD player could say have a Wi-Fi connection. So then you could get if you'd want Netflix movies to the thing. So that seems like a nice system. Now there's one output HDMI output on the TV on the receiver side. The nice thing is you can power this either with USB port or with just by plugging it into the wall. But a USB power is very nice because a lot of the new TVs, in addition to HDMI, they've got USB ports in the back. So you just plug it to a USB port in your TV, and then it uses the TV power to operate. So this is a very nice solution.
Yeah.
But it is $200. But you're going to have to pay something like that if you want it reliable. Now wireless is always a little bit more temperamental. It takes a few moments to sync up, and sometimes they will drop out if there's some big noise interference in the area. Now, the one disadvantage, I could say, it's not future-proofed. This will not transmit the new Ultra HD, which is 4K, Ultra HD 4K. So we're going from, instead of from 1080 horizontal lines, are going to four times 1080, mm-hmm. or 4,000 lines, and that's the new Ultra HD. And that and so it doesn't support Ultra HD, but it's going to be a good long while before you've got Ultra HD.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'd worry about it.
Sure.
And chances are you're not going to replace your current TV
for a while,
and yeah. I'm quite certain it's not an Ultra HD.
After all, it's a brand new flat screen that is mounted on the wall.
Yes.
As Don so kindly pointed
yes,
out.
Yes, it's brand new, and so that's a very nice solution. In fact, I'm going to do something like that in my house because I also have the ugly wire problem.
You have the wire police in your house.
I have wire police in the house, and so I'm going to have to deal with that one of these days.
Now, we were talking off the air about file sharing and about how I have to send large audio files via email, and even though you use Google, which allows you to send larger things, sometimes you go beyond their capacity. And I was lamenting the fact that sometimes I have to chop up some of my audio files, and then they have to be reassembled at the other end. You have a solution.
Yeah, there are several. I mean, you can actually upload to a cloud-based storage system. You could use iCloud if you would want. But the one that I like to use is Dropbox. Mm-hmm. It's really convenient. So I installed Dropbox on my desktop. I also installed a Dropbox client on my iPhone. And all I do then when I install the Dropbox client on my desktop, it creates a Dropbox subdirectory. And I simply drag files into that Dropbox subdirectory. And once I have logged on to my Dropbox account, which I set up, by the way, it's free, and they give you like a couple of gigabytes of storage or something. Once you do that, and once you synchronize with it, as soon as I drag a file into my Dropbox box, it shows up on my iPhone, my iPad, and all the devices that are on it. But the nice thing is I can right-click on that file, and it could be much larger than what you'd ever send by email. I could right-click on it, and it would say, "Would you like to share this?" And you say, and it gives you a link to share. Mm-hmm. You click on that option, and it copies the link, the public link that you can share for that particular file to your
email.
Yeah, not to your email, to your when you save something in it. What is it called when you saves it to your cache so you can
oh,
then,
right, sure.
So you can then save it, you can then paste it to your email.
Right.
And so it's very convenient. So like I had all these I use it to share drone pictures. Of course, you know, I put all my drone pictures in one big subdirectory by campus, and I just I created a public link for that for my drones, and I just shared it with everybody at Stratford, and mm-hmm. It was clipboard. It pastes it to your clipboard.
Right, okay.
That was the word that I forgot. Once you create the public link, it pastes that link into your clipboard, and it's got this long string of numbers because they don't need a password to get to it, but this is kind of protects you. So you could do that quite easily, and if you don't want to pay for your Dropbox after you've transferred the file, you could just delete it so you never build up the volume in that Dropbox at all.
This is this will save me time. It'll make the people on the receiving end much happier because it saves them work.
So they'll get the email. They'll just click on the link. It will bring up that file, and they can just copy that file. They can just download it then to their desktop. So that's a very good solution for you.
Very good.
We love all the emails. Send us your emails to techtalk@stratford.edu and check out the programs at Stratford by going to stratford.edu and looking at all their programs.
Of course, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, online at federalnewsradio.com. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software.
We seem to be having a little computer trouble here, so Doc, let us just continue on with the show. And of course, at this time of the morning, it is.
And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Big Voice. You're going to have to come in and, you know, cut your coffee break short to get in here on time.
I think I might need to see Andrew in the studio so we can work on this other issue while you talk about
profiles in IT. We're going to feature today Don Nguyen. Don Nguyen. Don Nguyen is the creator of Flappy Bird, a very, very popular mobile game. Don Nguyen was born in 1986 in Van Phuc, Vietnam, Van Phuc, Vietnam, which is just outside of Hanoi. His father owned a hardware store, and his mother worked for the government. they were able to purchase when he was just a young boy and a Nintendo clone. Because in Vietnam, they wouldn't get the real Nintendo. It was some knockoff clone. But still.
So was it black and white?
But still, Dong could play Super Mario. And he loved Super Mario. We'd always jump over these green pillars, you know. Super Mario. And, you know, we should have a little Super Mario music here. I played Super Mario many years ago. Now, by 16, Nguyen had learned to code his own computer chess game. So he's quite good at programming. 3 years later, when he was 19, while he was studying computer science, he placed in the top 20 in a programming competition at his university. He was going, and based on his results and his winning the in the top 20 at the programming competition, he got an internship with Punch Engineering, which is one of the few, or I think the only, gaming company in Vietnam. But, you know, he sort of got bored with Punch. He kept working there, but he just didn't fascinate him. What really fascinated him was the touch screen of his iPhone as a gaming interface. He got his new iPhone, and he said, wow, this is just fantastic. And But the games that they had on it, he didn't like. See, he liked games like Mario, like Super Mario and that sort of thing. Oh, there it is. Oh, yeah. Does that bring back memories?
No.
That brings back really memories. And that's what Dong Nguyen just loved. And that was his inspiration.
I wonder if they had knockoff music on his...
I don't know if they did or not. And so his inspiration, though, was the guy who wrote Pong. You remember Pong?
That was the one game that I did have.
Pong is, and so the creator of Pong had a philosophy: easy to learn, but difficult to win. And he said all games must be easy to learn, but difficult to win.
In order to
sell.
Makes sense.
And so he looked at the games on the iPhone, like Angry Birds. He said, well, these are actually too cluttered. They're too complicated. He says they don't meet his philosophy of easy to learn, but hard to win. So he actually, on April in 2013, I got the wrong date here, in April of 2013, just last April, actually, this was the weekend of reunification day in Vietnam, when the North Vietnamese were celebrating the reunification of Vietnam after the end of the Vietnamese War. Instead of going down to the celebration down in Hanoi, he decided to stay in his bedroom and create a new game. Now, he's living in his parents' house, by the way. So he spent all weekend creating this new game. He released that game, he worked on that game. Actually, a month earlier, he'd written another game called Shuriken Block. He felt it was a little too complicated. Basically, it's in Sheraton Block, you had stars dropping down, and you had to tap on the stars to keep them from getting impaled on spears. And the problem is you had to tap right on the star. And he said, well, this is just too complicated. He wanted a game that was either simpler, that would let the player tap anywhere on the screen and it would still work. So then he started thinking about that idea. And he had this pixelated bird which he'd drawn on his computer. He called it Cheep Cheeps. And he'd done this previously. It was sort of... And then he liked Super Mario with these green pipes that you had to jump over. Do you remember the green pipes?
Uh-huh.
So then he had Cheep Cheeps flying with these green... And he had this array of green pipes that Cheep Cheeps had to fly in between. And this was sort of, paying homage back to Super Mario.
Mm-hmm.
And the bird would have to navigate through gaps in these green pipes. But the bird was fighting gravity, and the gravity was so strong that you had to tap it to keep it flying, and if you'd miss a tap, it would crash and die. And so when he originally designed how the bird would die, he had it like blow up. It was this gory scene, and he says, I don't think I want to have all this death and destruction in my game. So he decided that whenever the bird would die, it would just plant its face. It would do a face plant. And they would have a kung fu style thwack music. And it was designed to kind of look funny. So that's what he did. He programmed that. The game went live on May 24th in the iOS in the Apple iOS App Store, May 24th of 2013. Now, he didn't charge anything for Flappy Bird. He decided that he would get revenue from in-game ads. So ads would pop up and he'd get a little bit of revenue. So and he just sent out one tweet and then he kind of forgot about it. And not much else happened. And then around November, around the end of December, all of a sudden, social media just exploded with talk about Flappy Bird. And people were complaining about it. They said, it's so hard to use. I wish I'd never started playing with it. But he said, I hate this game, but I can't stop playing it. And in the month of December, there were 17 million posts about Flappy Bird. By January 17th, Flappy Bird had hit number one on in the iPhone App Store. A week later, it was the top application in the Google Play Store, too. By February, it was topping the charts in more than 100 countries and had been downloaded more than 50 million times. And this little in-game ads, Nguyen was earning $50,000 a day.
Good grief.
Now, before long, because once people look at what other games he had done, and his Shuriken Block and a new game that he wrote, Super Ball Juggling, also went to the top 10, and they were earning money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nguyen was just a little embarrassed. He never told his parents about this game. So he was pulling in $50,000 a day, still living at home with his parents. And he said, I never told them about it because, they don't understand games. why even bother to tell my dad and mom about the thing? So it turned out, though, he was making so much money that there were TV news articles about him. He was on the TV news. They were talking about him in the newspaper. And his mom and dad were watching TV one night, and there was Dong's picture saying that this is the latest Vietnamese millionaire making money out of Flappy Bird. And they said, Dong, what's going on? What, you didn't tell us anything about it. He says, well, I was going to tell you about it, but, I never got around to it. And soon the local paparazzi were chasing him. He's kind of a shy, reclusive guy, if you look at his picture. And they besieged him, and so he was hiding in his parents' house, and he couldn't leave. And then he started getting messages from mothers accusing him of distracting the children of the world. Another mother complained that 13 kids in their school broke their iPhones playing Flappy Bird.
What?
Because they were banging on it so much. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't focus. He didn't want to go outdoors. He felt that this game had ruined his simple life.
Yeah.
In Van Phuc, Vietnam. You have to be very careful in that pronunciation of that name. I looked it up. It's a long U. I looked that name up. Van Phuc,
you're wound up
Vietnam.
Today. You had one too many McCafes today.
One too many. That is exactly the truth. So after tweeting, so then he realized the only way that he could bring order back to his life was to pull the game down.
Mm-hmm.
So after tweeting that he was going to take it down in 22 hours, another 10 million people downloaded it.
Jeez.
And then he hit the button, Flappy Bird disappeared. And then everybody wondered, who was this mystery Don Nguyen? They said, did this guy commit suicide? Did this guy, were there copyright violations? And Nintendo said that he had stolen some Super Mario ideas. Were there some government actions taken that he have to pull? None of that was true.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody could believe that anybody would just pull down something that was making money.
Sure.
Now, of course, just because he pulled it off the App Store did not mean that there weren't 50 million Flappy Bird apps out there on the phones.
Right.
So he was still making $50,000 a day on the installations that were there. And in fact, Flappy Bird was so popular that some people were putting their smartphones onto eBay, and if they had Flappy Bird installed, they were getting like $1,000 for it.
Good grief.
This is crazy.
Finally, he moved out of his parents' house.
Now that he's a multimillionaire.
he also quit his job there. Where was he working? I've sort of forgot where he was. At Punch Entertainment.
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, Punch Entertainment did not have anything to do with Flappy Bird.
Apparently not.
Because he did all of this at night on his own time. Well, he did. He did it on the reunification weekend, of course. And so, but he... So now he's actually living with a friend now. He didn't move into his own apartment.
But he's got all this money.
I know. But now he's thinking he's going to get his own apartment. This is his plan. He says, okay, I'm going to get my own apartment, and he's going to buy a new car.
Wow.
What do you think? What car do you think that Dong Nguyen would want to buy?
The cheapest bottom of the line Kia he could probably get his hands on, I'll bet.
Mini Cooper.
I mean,
a Mini Cooper kind of looks like a Flappy Bird car, don't you think?
It does, yeah.
So I think he's going to get a Mini Cooper. But now, after thinking about this a while, he's thinking, you know, maybe I'll release Flappy Birds again.
Yeah, I kind of like this whole money thing.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I'm going to have this Mini Cooper. I'm going to need gas money. I'm going to buy an apartment. So, but this time what he's going to do, he's going to build into the game a warning. That after somebody's played it like for 20 minutes, they say, maybe you should take a break and do something
else. Maybe you should go get a life now.
Yeah, so there you go. There's all you want to know about Dong Nguyen, the creator of Flappy Bird.
Flappy Bird.
That's right.
Well, I hope you're paying attention
Have you ever played Flappy Bird before?
I have zero games on any of my machines.
I'm not interested in playing Flappy Bird either.
Me neither. Yeah. Well, if you were paying attention, we won't give you Flappy Bird, but you can get free food from us. So stay tuned for the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and online at federalnewsradio.com. Be right back.
Technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to the Tech Talk of the Airways, classroom of the Airways.
Right, with the place with a broken computer.
Yeah, we got a little problem. Yeah. Is that an XP, by the way? Is that XP? Or would you check that? Would you check whether that's XP?
It says Piece O' Junk on it.
Piece O' Junk.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a Tandy, what was the Tandy computer from 1970-something?
Okay.
I digress.
I've never heard of Piso Junk.
it's an off-brand.
It's an off-brand.
It's available in the back of a truck on New York Avenue.
That's right. POJ.inc. So, earlier in the show, we were talking about Don Nguyen, creator of Flappy Birds. And, of course, he pulled it off the market, had it on the market, made lots of money. Still making lots of money. But where was his day job? Where was he working in the day while on the weekends he was programming games?
Yes. Now, you need to get that answer to us forthwith because time is running short. If you're calling from west of Van Phuc, Vietnam, it's 877-936-9333. East of Hanoi, it's 877-936-9333. For everybody else on, well, the globe, it's 877-936-9333, but you need the country code, which I don't know off the top of my head. Or
if you're calling from Galapagos Islands, you can call on Skype and just simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded free of charge to the studio.
I say 877-936-9333, but yes. You know, I could be wrong.
Now, if you get the correct answer, you get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Carême Dining Room, and you may be able to use them for one of our periodic Tech Talk dinners.
Yes.
Okay. The selfiest cities in the world. So Time has ranked them. Time magazine has gone to do some weighty things in this time, and this is this world, and this is one of the other things. What they did, they actually built a database of more than 400,000 Instagram photos, which were tagged selfies. Now, these selfies actually include geographic coordinates. They've got all the GPS data. You can tell within 10 feet of where somebody took the picture, even if it's anonymous. So they took all the geographic coordinates from these Instagram photos, and then they mapped them into a map, and they put them into cities. And they ended up ranking 459 cities to determine which were the selfiest places on Earth. The number one city, Makati City, Philippines. Who would have thought that?
I never
258
would.
Selfies per 100,000 people. The number two city, Manhattan, New York.
No kidding.
202 selfies per 100,000 people. The number three city, Miami, Florida. I could have predicted that.
Sure.
155 selfies per 100,000 people. Anaheim and Santa Ana, California, number four. 147 selfies per 100,000 people. Then we go all the way, then we leave the U.S. We go to Malaysia. We go. Tel Aviv is number six. Milan, Italy is number eight. Georgetown, Malaysia is number nine. We go down all the way. Florence, Italy is number 22. And Washington, D.C., number 25 in the selfiest cities, sending out 66 selfies per 100,000 people.
Wow.
Probably. How many senators do we have?
More than that.
Yeah. So
it's two per state last I checked.
Two per state. That's right.
Doc, we don't have a winner yet, so let's ask the question, and you'll talk about another item here.
Well, I'll talk about another item.
Computer.
We had Don Nguyen, of course, inventor of Flappy Birds. He was writing his games on the weekend and at night, but he had a day job.
Right.
What was his day job? Where did he work for his day job?
And ironically enough, the name of his day job is what I'm just about to do to the computer that's not working over here. So give us a call, 877-936-9333.
It is the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. On March 12th, 1989, British computer scientist Tim Berners-Lee, who we featured on Profiles in IT before, published a proposal for an information management system built on top of the Internet. It stipulated that the Internet could be more useful if there was some sort of graphical representation of the information that was being shared around the network. At that point, the Internet had actually been around for a couple of decades.
Wow.
But it was used mainly by scientists, you know, to upload files. It had no real interface. It was just like a computer network, but it wasn't user-friendly. So Tim Berners-Lee was specific to CERN, which is where he worked there. CERN, of course, has the Large Hadron Collider. That's what they worked on over there. But soon, once he developed this interface, it grew much larger than a single lab. So the World Wide Web and the Internet are not the same thing. So the Internet is just the network of computers that are connected together. The World Wide Web is actually a protocol that uses HTML that makes that Internet easier to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
And you have things like links. So if you're using something like Skype or using email, you're using the Internet, you're not using the World Wide Web. If you're on your browser and you're surfing the web, doing Google lookups or going to websites, you're using the World Wide Web. Now, but the World Wide Web is actually kind of being left behind to a certain degree because people are doing less and less surfing, and they're letting applications do it for them. For instance, when I do research for Tech Talk, I use Flipboard.
Okay.
So I've put in all of my keywords that I want, and Flipboard goes out, it searches all around, and it creates a little magazine for me. And so I just simply flip through the magazine and decide what I'm going to talk about each week. So it does all the research for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an application on my iPhone.
Cool.
So over time, we're getting more and more applications. In fact, companies would like to create applications and keep everybody inside of their applications. So like Amazon would like you to shop inside of Amazon. And so there's a transition from the old Wild West where you're just surfing around in sites, different sites around the web, and then moving toward applications. So the Internet is evolving. Now, the biggest threat that Tim Berners-Lee feels that the Internet suffers is the possibility that we're going to lose Internet neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
He's really worried about that. So he believes that we need to get an Internet Bill of Rights or something passed which will, in fact, ensure that there's not a bias in bandwidth between different applications. So we have a free and open web format, and that we don't turn the power of the web over to commercial interests only. I kind of agree with Tim Berners-Lee. We just have to find a way so that the people that are providing the infrastructure upon which the Internet is built have a fair way to get paid for their investment. But then I think this is really a major point. So there you go, the 25th anniversary of the invention of the World Wide Web.
Okay, we do have a contestant on the phone. Let's go to line number one. This is our friend Marty calling from Falls Church, Virginia. Good morning, Marty. How are you, sir?
Good morning.
All right, Dr. Church, ask the question,
early
please.
In the show we talked about Dong Nguyen, of course, inventor of Flappy Birds. Where was his day job?
At Punch.
At Punch, that is correct. Punch Entertainment. You win two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, the Karim Dining Room. Just stay on the line, and we'll get those tickets out to you next week.
Very good.
Yes.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for listening. Hang on the phone. We will give you over to Andrew Mitchell, who is our vice president. I'm sorry, he's our adjunct professor.
Yes.
I just elevated him without the raise pay.
No, you can't elevate him to the vice presidential level because he still does things useful.
Oh, he is our adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd control here on Tech Talk Radio. And this is, of course, the train wreck this morning that we call Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and on the World Wide Web at... what is it? Federalnewsradio.com. Let's see what happens when I push a button.
At techtalkradio.com.
That's right. Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Hang on. We're going to push a button and see what happens.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcast.
Well, like I said, we're going to push buttons until they work, and they don't work right now.
Well, so, I think we should talk about Pi Day.
I think we should talk about Pi Day, too.
You know, Jim, I was going to bring in a couple of McDonald's apple pies to celebrate Pi Day, and I completely blew it. We could have, so I'm telling you what my plan was.
You know, and my plan was that I was going to go to this place in Baltimore called Dangerously Delicious Pies and bring you a pie, but that didn't happen either.
So we have two Phantom Pies have have bitten the dust.
Mm-hmm.
Well, across the country, math geeks in museums and schools and private groups gather to celebrate the number pi, which is approximately 3.14, which is why March 14th is Pi Day. March is the third month and the 14th day, 3.14. And the other thing is, did you know that Albert Einstein was born on this day?
I did not know.
It's very, very important. Yeah, Albert, and that's a perfect day for Albert Einstein to be born. Now, pi, of course, is the distance around a perfect circle or circumference divided by the distance across it or diameter. And it's a constant number, 3.14, but actually it's an indefinite number, and if you start just writing all the digits, they'll go all the way out to infinity without it's an irrational number, as they say. It'll go all the way out to infinity without any sort of repeating pattern. And so the first few digits, 3.14159, which is what I always use when I do my calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
your pi calculations.
The House of Representatives, you know, because these guys really like to move in and do important stuff. In 2009, they designated March 14th as National Pi Day.
Okay.
And I'm glad that Congress was really on the ball to really
taxes.
Do this thing. Now, this Pi Day was started actually by Larry Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1988, he worked in the electronics group at San Francisco's Exploratorium, which is a museum. And so last year was Pi Day's 25th anniversary at that museum. And what they do on Pi Day, they gather a small group of staff, and then they feature a pi procession. And what they do is they give attendees a number, 0 through 9, and the attendees have to line up in the order of pi. You know, and you know, it's got an infinite number of digits, so they just keep lining up, and everybody makes a pi procession, having all the digits in line. Now, Princeton, New Jersey has Pi Day, and it's on Thursday night. They start out with a reading by physicist Charles Adler, and then they go into a full day of activities on Fridays, including a walking tour of Einstein's neighborhood. Then they do a pizza pie making contest. Then they have a pie eating contest at McCaffrey Supermarket. And then they have an Albert Einstein look-alike competition. So that's really quite the nice event. In Boston, everybody can head up to MIT at Pi Time, which is 3.14 p.m., and they can have a pie-throwing contest where you throw a pie at your best friend, and it's recorded with high-speed cameras. Now, next year, as you were saying earlier, it's going to be even bigger. Because it's going to be 2015, so it's going to be 3.1415. You see, we already have the first few digits, and then if you go to 9:26 a.m., you're going to have 3.1415926, which of course are the first digits of pi, and that will be a tremendous, tremendous minute to celebrate. So I'm looking forward to Pi Day next year, and we're going to have some kind of major celebration. I hope Pi Day falls on a Saturday someday, so we can really do it up right.
That would be good.
So should we talk about the progress bar? Or what
I think
that would
be.
Do?
Yeah, we have time. No, I think we need to run out the clock today, because I don't know what's going to happen when I push buttons.
We
over
need
here.
To run off the clock
uh-huh.
because I think you need the buttonless mouse over there because none of the buttons are working. And I'll get into that in a minute.
I think that's a great
idea. Okay, who made the progress bar? Everybody wants to know about that. Haven't you ever wondered? You know, you got that little thermometer turned on its side, and it sort of goes across there, and so. At 1985, in a 1985 conference in the field of human-computer interfaces, a graduate student by the name of Brad A. Myers, presented a paper on the importance of what he called percent done progress indicators. He had the idea that they would be useful and important, and they felt that they weren't used enough. Now, Brad Myers is now on the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University. Now, he told his colleagues at the practice bars made the computer users less anxious and the more efficient. It could help them relax because, you see, back in those days, computers were slow. They would hang up a lot. And so you're sitting there waiting, and then you wonder, has the computer locked up? Should I reboot it? What should I do? And you get very anxious. But if that little progress bar is moving, you say, okay, some progress is going on. And it allowed users to relax. So it's all about how the user feels while he's waiting.
Ah.
So to prove his point, and actually they did research, and then users felt that it went faster when they had a progress bar because they had something to look at. Now, to prove his point, Myers asked 48 fellow students to run searches on a computer database with and without a progress bar. Now, for his progress bar, he took a capsule and he filled it from left to right. It looked like a giant thermometer, like they'd been using for the charity drives. You've seen these charity drives
and
it blows out the top.
Yeah, right.
So he just took a charity drive thermometer and turned it on its side. And he let them rate the experience, and 86% of them said they liked the progress bars. And that rest is history. They've become ubiquitous.
Pretty neat. They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. So that kind of an interesting thing. And so it was a good idea. Back, a lot of stuff for computers was invented in the mid-80s because that's when things were being developed. Talk about the buttonless mouse.
Mm-hmm.
It was created accidentally. Sometimes the biggest innovations and most important discoveries don't come as a result of some creative minds putting together, making a single progress.
You mean they're mistakes?
They just happen by chance, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's what happened when they created the buttonless mouse. Abraham Farrakh, who was a former Apple senior mechanical engineer in the product design group, explained the events that led up to this design. It all started in 1999. Now, they'd made six great form models to show Steve, because Steve liked to feel. You know, he was like a touchy-feely kind of guy. So they made six models of a mouse, different shapes, different lanes, different curviness, to show Steve. And they were completely done. They had all of the lines for the buttons cut. They'd sort of cut in lines to show where the buttons would be. They were all colors were just right. And then at the 11th hour, one of the engineers said, wait a minute here. I got another idea for making a curved mouse. So they threw it together, but the problem was there wasn't quite enough time. They didn't have enough time to finish it, you know, to cut the little grooves where the buttons would be, and so it just wasn't finished. So Farrakh and his crew, they really weren't proud of this creation. They said it just looked like a gray blob. So they sort of hid it in the box. Then Steve showed up. And Steve looked around at the lineup, and he saw this box with this gray blob, and he pulled out the blob. And Steve looked at that. He says, that's genius. We don't want any buttons. Someone in the room said, that's right, Steve. No buttons at all. And the rest is history.
There you go. That's pretty funny.
That's right. So let's talk about U.S. mobile data revenues.
Yes.
This is kind of a big – this is a – you know, it used to be that phone companies made their money on voice – making voice connections and voice calls. But this year, 2014, will be the first year that data revenues are going to outsell voice revenue. This is like a tipping point.
Yeah, sure. This
is, because now, I mean, telephone providers are going to turn into basically bandwidth providers.
Mm-hmm.
And all the telephone is going to be, all the phoning is going to be done with applications like Skype or voice over IP. So mobile data revenues in the U.S. were $90 billion in 2013. And this year, we will be the first country that will pass $100 billion annually in data revenues. And this year, data revenues will exceed voice revenues for the first time. But we're not actually the first country to do this. We're the seventh. Japan was the first in 2017. And this is all because of smartphone penetrations and tablets, where Apple and, of course, Android dominate the market. Listen, the show just ended so quickly.
It did.
And we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. And make certain to go out and check out the programs at Stratford by going to the website stratford.edu and sign up for our podcast at techtalkonline.com.
If you tuned in later, we'd like to hear any portion of the show again. This Tech Talk broadcast will replay at 2 o'clock here today on Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We have lots of basketball on the air today. GW takes on VCU this afternoon. That's at 4 o'clock. And then tonight, NBA action. The Wizards at the Brooklyn Nets. That starts at 6:45. Sun's supposed to come out today. 61 for the high. Right now, it is 51 outside our studios in Northwest at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors.